Welcome to the Florida Roundup statewide. Great to have you along on this Friday, live during the noon hour. I'm Tom Hudson in Miami.
And I'm Melissa Ross in Jacksonville. Well, the big story this week is the COVID-19 virus. It keeps spreading in Florida. In fact, a record number of Florida residents were diagnosed with the virus on Thursday. More than 3,300 of you out there. And more than 15,000 Floridians have tested positive for the disease in just the past week. Now, while more people are getting tested, the percentage of people testing positive is simply going up, above 10% for two out of the past 3 days. With these numbers rising, on Monday, Governor Ron DeSantis defended how he has handled the pandemic.
We're not shutting down. You know, we're going to go forward. We're going to continue to protect the most vulnerable. You know, we're going to continue to advise, particularly our elderly population, to maintain social distancing, avoid crowds.
This week, the state said the median age of people getting the virus has dropped from 65 years old down to 37 years old. Statewide, hospital beds are about 75% full, and hospital visits for flu-like and COVID-like symptoms have been climbing. As the numbers have been trending higher, several cities now require people to wear masks in public places. Rick Kreisman is the mayor of St. Pete.
We've all seen the signs, no shoes, no shirt, no service. Well, I'm going to suggest you add masks to that, with or without a city order. So if someone is in violation or they refuse to put on a mask or to leave, call us. We have your back.
St. Pete is not alone. Tampa, Orange County, including Orlando, doing it. The Florida Keys also now requires masks in public. Bob Eady is the top public health official in the Keys.
If anyone has been down Duval Street in the last few days, you will notice that not only do I not see people wearing masks, I don't even see people carrying masks.
And there's a new mandate to wear those masks in many other public places in Florida. Are you concerned about the rising rate of COVID-19 here in the Sunshine State? How much of it can be explained by more testing? Are reopening efforts working against public health measures? What protective measures are you taking or have you decided not to take? 305-995-1800, live statewide during the noon hour Eastern time here, 305-995-1800. Or you can join us on social media. Our Twitter handle is at Florida Roundup.
Already getting your tweets. We'll get a few of those on in a moment. Right now, we're pleased to welcome Dr. Aileen Marty. She's an infectious disease specialist at Florida International University's College of Medicine and a pandemic expert. She's studied them throughout the world. Dr. Marty, thanks for being with us this Friday.
Oh, it's always a pleasure. Thanks for having me.
Now, Governor DeSantis has said there will be no more lockdowns of Florida, that the economy simply has to reopen. You've stated in recent days, though, that the governor's push to reopen could backfire. How concerned are you about this, given the sharp rise in COVID cases we're seeing this week across the state?
I'm very concerned, not because of whether we lock down or not lock down. That's not the key. The key is how do we behave? Do we apply the public health safety concepts and, you know, what data has shown us works, or do we not? Do we ignore them and cavalierly allow the virus to go from person to person? So we, in theory, can have an open economy as long as we follow the public health guidelines, as long as we follow the new normals. If we don't, then we may again see rates so high and so dangerous that we have to go into a lockdown. And I would love for us to avoid that.
Sure. We are seeing positive test rates rise above 10% in some Florida counties. That is a key marker that has prompted lockdowns in the past. Now, as Tom pointed out a minute ago, mayors around the state now are starting to mandate that people wear masks when they're out in public. But this is a patchwork affair in Florida. You know, a lot of this is dependent on the goodwill of all of us to do the right thing. There isn't a statewide mandate, for example, to wear masks and to take those kinds of measures to slow the spread of the virus. Do you think there should be?
Absolutely. There absolutely should be. And it's now been proven. Study after study shows that use of masks decreases transmission of this monster virus. And we should be wearing masks while this pandemic is, while this virus is in our community, and we should consider it the same as stopping at a stop sign. We stop at a stop sign, it protects us and it protects others, and it's the rule. And that's what it should be, the rule for now, because it's the right thing to do.
We'll go to your calls for pandemic expert Dr. Aileen Marty in a moment. She's an infectious disease specialist at FIU. 305-995-1800 to join the Florida Roundup. You know, doctor, doing these public health actions shouldn't be political, but it's become political. Mask wearing in particular. You're more likely to see a Democratic mayors or governors mandate mask wearing than Republican ones. And we've certainly seen that here in Florida. What are your thoughts about the way this procedure to limit the spread of the virus has become politicized?
The virus doesn't care about our politics. The virus is a piece of genetic information that wants to go from one host to the next, and it's going to take that opportunity. And any group, whatever their belief systems, politics, ideologies are, again, virus doesn't care. If your group is going to make it easier for the virus to get from one host to another, it's going to do it. And so it's increasing the risk to people of that mindset.
Dr. Marty, it's Tom Hudson. Let's talk a little bit about the data that the Department of Health in Florida releases each and every day and the data that the governor points to. The governor this week has pointed to the increase in the number of positive cases because of increased testing. Is that an accurate analysis?
If you just look at the raw numbers by themselves, and that were your only indicator, and you were doing more testing, which we are, then that would be an adequate answer. But we're looking at the percent positive going up. And we have been testing high-risk populations for a long time now. We've been testing jails. We've been testing nursing homes. We've been testing that. That's not new. So what's going on is a true increase. Moreover, we're seeing more cases that are presenting to hospitals, more cases that are being hospitalized, and our ICU beds are, again, acquiring more and more cases of COVID-19 patients. That's not an artifact of testing.
On the state dashboard, Dr. Marty, when one looks at the testing data, the number that the state puts in front of people to look at is, today, I think it's 5.6 or 5.8% of positive tests. That's a number that includes all tests given in Florida since day one. Is that an accurate way to reflect the percent positive testing in Florida?
It doesn't reflect what's happening today. So it clearly provides a misleading picture of the reality of our current situation. We have to test what's happening today, and we have to show the data accurately so that people can make the right decisions, the best way of helping themselves.
Let's go to some calls.
Melissa,
now
Aileen.
Yeah
We've got Tess in Jensen Beach called 305-995-1800. Tess, you are on the radio, go ahead. Tess, you with us in Jensen Beach?
Yes. Hello.
There we go. Go ahead, Tess. You're on the radio with Melissa, Tom, and Dr. Marty at FIU.
Okay, hi. My question was, out of all of the testing that is being done, say a million tests get done, what is the percentage that is showing up positive? Is it 50%, 10% that's coming out positive? That's what I'm wondering.
Well, which county are you in, Tess?
Martin County.
You're in Martin County. Okay, I'll let Dr. Marty answer. I got the data here in front of me. I'm going to look it up real quick, Dr. Marty.
Yeah, and it varies by county, but a lot of the big counties above 10% now, correct, doctor?
That's correct. And what more importantly, what we want is to have a percent positive of 5% or less, or ideally no percent positive, but to open up to be 5% or less. And that's been creeping up over the last few days. In fact, in Miami-Dade, it was up as high as 14.27% just yesterday. And today it's at, day before yesterday. Yesterday it was at 13%. We'll see what today shows. But those are much higher numbers than what we were seeing in Miami-Dade just a couple of weeks ago.
And so, Dr. Marty, I have the Martin County numbers up as of about 11 o'clock this morning through yesterday, Thursday. 22% of those tested in Martin County on Thursday came back positive. Now, there is a rule of small numbers here. Only 270 people were tested on Thursday. 76, though, however, came back as positive for the coronavirus.
Hmm. Yeah. Daniel in Sarasota with us now. Daniel in Sarasota, thanks for calling in. Go ahead. Hey, Daniel, you're on the radio. Go ahead.
Okay. Can you hear me?
Yeah.
Sure. So I have a kind of two-part question. Dr. Marty, first, although the cases are rising, I've seen the 7-day average of death toll has been falling more or less since May. And also with the drop of the median age of the average person testing, doesn't that lend credence to the theory that this is also a result of more people being tested and younger people who are asymptomatic being tested? And secondly, with the studies coming out of China recently that antibodies might not last for more than a couple months, how does that affect the theory or the strategy to have a vaccine implemented when it looks like antibodies might not last for any significant amount of time?
Yeah, great questions from Daniel there. Dr. Marty.
Daniel, I could kiss you. Those are such fantastic
But questions. You wouldn't, though, Dr. Marty, right?
No.
Just
social
virtually,
distancing.
Okay? Yeah, come on.
So let's talk about age, number one. So you have three questions here. You have about age, you have about death rate, and you have antibodies. So let's start with age, because that was your first part of your question. Yes, the age rate, the median age at which we're seeing positive cases is dropping. There's several reasons for that. Part of the reason is the expanded testing that we've done more recently, and that is, in fact, going to capture younger people. The way we were testing in the United States in the beginning, when we even first started doing testing at the community level, was we were at first restricting it only to the severest cases, which, because of the nature of this virus, is going to be the older age range. So there's part of that artifact as we've shifted how we test. Yes. The next thing is the death rate. Now, the most important reason, really, for the decrease in the death rate is the physicians and the nurses and the entire hospital staff understanding better when to give which drugs to which patients and teasing out the way the disease works. That's the main reason that the death rate is going down. Although you're right that as we capture more of the younger population, that's less likely to end up critically ill and dying. That's part of the influence as well. So it's a combination effect, but the greatest effect is the death rate. The death rate is what we have learned, how we are completely managing the cases differently. And the last thing that you asked about shows me that you're up to date, and you're absolutely right. Today there was a very excellent publication done in a wonderful journal that shows how people, particularly asymptomatic people, lose their antibodies within 2 to 3 months of exposure to this virus. And how does it change things? It only changes things for those who never understood coronavirus in the first place, because if you know about coronaviruses at all, you will know that the other six don't have long-lasting neutralizing antibodies anyway. So that's always been a problem, and that's always been a huge concern of mine, because as we see younger people as our predominant category of people who are getting infected, and they're not reacting, which part of the reason people get sick and end up in the hospital is an overreactive immune system. By not reacting and by not producing lifelong immunity from it, that means they're going to lose their immunity and they're going to get reinfected. And if they continue to be cavalier about it, these potential reinfections later on down the road as they get older and maybe acquire some underlying conditions means that the risk is just going to be pushed further into the future. And that's a problem unless we take the public health measures that other countries like Iceland and New Zealand have done to get the stupid virus out of our community.
Dr. Eileen Marty is a pandemic and infectious disease specialist at Florida International University, taking your phone calls and tweets here on the Roundup. Linda sent us this tweet. Dr. Marty, can you clarify what reporting on test results means? Linda's asking, does it mean that we're looking at the number of cases, number of tests performed that may include individual persons tested multiple times?
So that's a very important question as well. What do test results mean? And the way that we're receiving the data is based on the results of people who test positive, period, right? So, but we're not including in the Florida Department of Health, it's not including in the data individuals who test for antibodies, only people who test for the nucleic acids, the RNA of the virus, using our PCR samples. So the absolute number has to do strictly with the accumulated number of individuals. So if an individual tested once positive for this and they get retested to see how they're doing, let's say they've survived and we're seeing if they can go back out into the community, that's not going to be counted as a new case.
Not going to be counted. Let me get a few more calls on for you, doctor. Let's go to Dawn in Tampa. There's a positive COVID test rate there of about 14%, by the way. Dawn, you're on the air. Go ahead.
Hi. I recently put my child, my two-year-old, in daycare for the very first time. I had to go back to work. When I got there, they were so overwhelmed with demand. Parents were gathered together, not wearing masks, dropping their kids off. I asked if they had a plan in place to address social distancing, and their response was, maybe this is not the place for you.
Oh, boy. So I assume you'll take your child elsewhere.
I'm worried about school reopening as well.
Sure.
You know, the problem is, it's that way everywhere. There's such a demand for childcare right now. They're overwhelmed. And we're also talking about reopening schools.
Dawn, I hear you. And that's a concern so many parents have. Dr. Marty, we're getting tweets about this too. People worried about sending their kids back to school. And what about Dawn and parents like her? What are their options here?
That is one of the most serious issues that we're dealing with. So actually, I'm working with the superintendent here in Miami, Carvello, who is very thoughtful about the issue. And the mayor here, Mayor Jimenez, has also worked with the schools and with the daycares to institute rules that we call part of the new normal to minimize the risk of daycares. The description of what Dawn saw at the daycare that she went to is absolutely tragic, because it's part of the reason that our community isn't effectively getting this virus out, which is what we want to do. So I'm very, very sorry to hear about what's going on in, I forgot what county she is in.
In Tampa,
but
yeah.
In Tampa, yeah. No, that is completely unacceptable.
But yeah, I mean, we're hearing that from people around the state. And hold that thought. And people keep giving us a call here on the Florida Roundup as we take a short break. But when we return, more of your calls and tweets about the uptick in coronavirus across Florida. What are your thoughts and concerns about that? Tweet us at Florida Roundup. Calls to 305-995-1800. As we look at how the state is handling this, we're setting new one-day records in COVID. We'll be right back. This is the Florida Roundup from Florida Public Radio. Welcome back to the Florida Roundup. Thanks for being with us this Friday. I'm Melissa Ross in Jacksonville.
And I'm Tom Hudson in Miami. We're talking about the increase in COVID-19 infections in Florida. This week, several counties reported a daily infection rate of over 10%. That's a key gauge for reopening efforts. 305-995-1800, 305-995-1800. At Florida Roundup on Twitter. We got a message on Twitter from Claudia that says, thank you for inviting Dr. Eileen Marty from FIU to your show and answer questions the community has. This is what we need, intelligent, efficient, and passionate physician experts to be leading the task force of COVID-19 in Florida. So Dr. Marty got a fan there, and Claudia on Twitter, appreciate that. Let's go to Matthew in Bradenton on line 10. Matthew, you are on the radio. Go ahead.
Hi, thank you so much for being here. So I was wondering, I have a bunch of friends that are going out to social, to like parties, social gatherings. I have a friend who's having a bridal shower this weekend, and but at the same time, like I'm getting the advice to not go to these things, and so I don't go to them. But everyone is doing it, and I just kind of feel like a crazy person. And I just kind of want to hear from you, an epidemiologist, like what are we supposed to be doing right now in terms of social gatherings? What is the right thing to be doing?
Matthew, appreciate that. Dr. Marty, let's run through some of these things. What about Matthew and a bridal shower? What should he consider?
So Matthew, that's a really challenging question because, you know, you're pitted against emotional and social needs and norms with the reality of this horrific outbreak, this horrific virus that's among us. So the way to look at any event is to do a risk assessment, right? So what are the odds with X number of people, whatever that X is, that one or more is going to have the virus and be pre or asymptomatic and be able to spread it to the rest of the group? This is how you really have to approach it. And then what is going to be in place to reduce that risk when you put more people in a setting? Because the more people there are, the higher the odds are that there's going to be one or more people who can be spreading the virus to everybody else. So the way to hold any of these types of gatherings is to hold it with awareness, with knowledge that we're taking a risk. Let's minimize that risk as much as we can, because these important life events, like a bridal shower, are some of our emotional needs. So reduce the total number who attend, keep the social distancing in the event, go ahead and use the masks, and be aware of the hygiene. Get your sanitizer with you.
All right, Dr. Marty, it has been 3.5 months since I've had a haircut. I need a haircut. I'll tell you, I don't have a lot of hair left, but that what I do have is just unruly. What considerations
should I be
thinking?
I'm trying to picture that from up here in Jacksonville right now. I'm
it's
trying
not
to get a
mental sight,
a visual
Marissa.
On that.
It is not a handsome sight.
Okay.
Well, I think a lot of us are in that boat, and and the bottom line is, it's the same story. What are the measures that are being taken by your barber or your salon to reduce the risk? So again, here, we've spent months here in Miami-Dade going through how we can open each and every kind of business and looking at the unique factors and even visiting the various businesses, whether it was restaurants or hotels or barbershops, to see how they operate and how to switch it to make it safer. So the bottom line is, what are the rules in your county, and are the people, do the rules make sense? Do they follow what we know about how this virus is transmitted? And if they're following those rules, then you can, of course, it's always a little bit of a risk, but yeah, much less if you follow the rules and go ahead and get your hair cut.
I got my hair cut last week, and after months of not having it done, and they only let one customer in at a time at the salon. Everyone was masked and gloved up. They took my temperature when I walked in. It seems, you know, individual businesses are making individual choices, and that's great. You know, but we're getting all these tweets about this, too. Here's one for you from Josh in Jacksonville. He says, the worst thing for business is uncertainty. They just want to know what to do and when to do it. All this back and forth will ultimately make the economic downturn worse than if they had simply stayed closed for longer, he says. Doctor, not every business owner out there would agree with that, I don't think. But do you think the state opened too soon, given what we're seeing now?
So I have to say, I have to thank Josh for his question. And I'll tell you, the bottom line is not so much when we open, but how we open and whether or not people abide by the new normal. We can have open businesses if they utilize all these strict guidelines. I know they're unpleasant. I know that it's expensive to have new MERV level 13 filters installed in your HVAC system. I understand these things, but ultimately it is cheaper and better for our economy to do things right. You know, you cannot have a healthy economy if a very large percentage of your population is sick. And one of the things people don't realize about COVID-19 survivors, right, especially particularly those that have been in the ICU, is they continue to have problems months after they have been released from the ICU. This is a long-lasting problem to our community. We need to cut it off at the knees. So those measures, we can open the economy, but we have to do it recognizing what the risks are and how to minimize the risks while we do so.
Let's go to Travis in Orlando. He's got some thoughts about how we open things back up. Hi, Travis. Go ahead.
Hey, thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
Actually, I think you touched on it with Josh's question, but it's related. What I've noticed in the conversations around COVID is that there tend to be just two camps kind of digging their heels in, those that, you know, insist on sacrificing the economy on the altar of health, and then, you know, those that insist on sacrificing health on the altar of the economy. I was wondering, because I noticed the conversations sort of stall out at that point. So what do you tell to somebody who says that those are the only two options and that there's no middle ground?
Yeah, it has been presented as a binary choice. I think that's a great point, Travis. And, Doctor, you know, the governor, too, has talked about the need to balance economic imperatives against public health. This is a difficult path to walk for any public official. But what about Travis's question?
So, Travis, I think you're touching on a fundamental problem of U.S. society today, and I think it's incredibly sad because we're losing that ability to find compromise, which has worked so brilliantly for this nation for over 200 years. And I think that it's imperative that people not politicize this issue because the virus has no politics. The virus has no ideology. And when we start to do that, we're losing a sense of what we can do to better ourselves. And we cannot forget the reality that a sick population doesn't function as well. An ill population doesn't function as well and cannot have good travel and trade. And other countries will shun us if we don't figure out how to solve our health problem. So if you want a good economy, or someone does, all of us do, then we also have to have good health. And you have to make health an independent factor for how, think about this. If you are not healthy, you are not, your cognitive abilities go down. And that's as true for a school child as it is for a business owner or anyone else. You are not able to make your best decisions. So it's best to have an open economy with an awareness of the rules that can be in place to keep us healthy.
We're speaking with Dr. Eileen Marty, infectious disease specialist at FIU, about the uptick in coronavirus in Florida. 305-995-1800 to join us here at Florida Roundup. Dr. Marty, I'm sitting here up in the northern part of the state, Jacksonville, where city officials are preparing to host the Republican National Convention here in August. Of course, Jacksonville is getting the event because North Carolina essentially told Republicans and the president, no, we will not allow you to have a packed event with no social distancing. We're going to be getting an event with up to 20,000 attendees watching the president accept his party's nomination for four more years as president. There has been a fair bit of concern about how this event could further spread COVID in North Florida. There has also been some unrest or discomfort about large-scale protests around the state in recent weeks and how those might have been spreading the disease. So whether it's a political gathering or an outdoor protest, how much is what's going on in our politics and our society right now that's driving these gatherings worrying you as an infectious disease expert?
Thank you for the question. And this is something that to me speaks to an underlying problem with our entire education system, in that we are not showing our population how to do critical thinking, how to make evidence-based decisions. If our population simply looked at the actual raw data that the rest of us are looking at carefully, those of us who study this thing, and they saw how incredibly dangerous this virus is, they wouldn't be randomly throwing caution to the wind. As I've said before, it's like running a red light here. They're running the red light, and yes, you might get away with it a few times running that red light, but eventually you're going to cause a major accident. And when we don't pay attention to following those things that have gotten us to where we are, which is, you know, all the remarkable revolutions in science and innovation and medicine that has allowed us to keep the percent of death as low as it is, because this raw virus, without modern medicine, without ICUs, without treatment, has the capability of infecting at least 75% of humans on Earth, and 20% would die, which means 1 billion people would die without modern medicine and tools. And that's what people have to understand about this virus. We have to respect it for the danger that it is, and do what we can to eliminate it from our community so we can get back to real normal.
Dr. Marty, Ian in Miami has a question about the evidence here, the data, particularly kind of what's most important with all the numbers that we see. Ian, you're on the radio. Go ahead.
Hi. I just want to start off and say that I'm a student at FIU, and it's really inspires confidence to know that the public health school is so outspoken. I don't know. I was kind of skeptical before about going back to school in fall, but you inspire good confidence. My question was, there's a lot of models and people on Twitter, analysts, math people, you know, all this stuff going around. And I see stuff like on COVID-19-projections.com. They have an estimate of the current infected. Another site is RT Live, and they estimate the R naught. What is your opinion on all these various models, and how accurate do you think they are?
Ian, we appreciate the call. Let me remind folks that you are listening to the Florida Roundup from Florida Public Radio. Dr. Eileen Marty, an infectious disease specialist at FIU, which data should we be paying close attention to? Which models?
Thank you. That's a challenging question, because no model is going to be perfect. It's not, you know, it's kind of like looking at predictions of where the hurricane is going to hit. We use the best information we have available and try to respond to it. I think the best models are watching what has already been effective. So I think instead of looking at these predictive models, let's look at what happened in Iceland. I mean, Iceland is a country. Yes, given it's true that it's an island, and therefore it makes it a little bit easier to do what needs to be done. But Katrin Jakobsdóttir, the prime minister there, did intensive tracking and tracing of cases, which is something we know scientifically is the best way to isolate. First of all, you isolate cases who are positive, and you quarantine their closest contacts. But the contacts that are intimate, so household members, people that you work with all the time, should also be tested And if you then follow those people up and you keep the virus from circulating in the community, you can get rid of the virus. So Iceland has gotten rid of the virus and will soon be able to have a completely open economy. The same thing in New Zealand. So we can see that there are three ways that we can tackle this virus. We can do it pharmaceutically, which includes two of the ways, which is either a vaccine or an antiviral. Those will work eventually once we have them. But the other way, the third way, is using known public health measures. And we know enough about how this virus is transmitted and where the risk points are that countries can and have effectively gotten the virus out of their community using simple public health tools, which,
using
by the way,
tools. And let me just interject and say we have many more tweets than we could ever get on the air. But here's one from Jessica. She says, my husband and I are trying to decide if it's safe to send our kids to summer camp. Our pediatricians say it's safe and we have to work, but we're worried about the virus. Lots of questions like that coming into the show right now. Let's go to Mackie in Sarasota. He's on the line. Mackie, or she's on the line. Mackie, go ahead.
It's a she.
It's a she.
Thank you for taking my call.
Go ahead, Mackie.
Yes, I have a question about the testing in general. I'm a former healthcare provider, and you've got specificity and sensitivity. And it seems that the tests that are being used, and there are far too many tests being used, have a low sensitivity and may be showing 40% of...
All right. And not to cut you off, Mackie, but we're almost to a commercial break here. Doctor, could you answer her quickly?
Thanks, Mackie. That's an important point because a lot of people are confused about the testing. So there are three different things we can look for. One is we can look for the RNA of the virus. Those are your PCR tests. And the next is an antibody test, which is a host response to the virus. And the third thing is an antigen test, which looks for protein of the virus. And all three
and,
have
and that's
their...
the short answer, the very short answer, right? Listen, I...
Well,
and I,
it didn't get into her specificity and sensitivity issue, but okay.
And I'm sorry to cut you off too, Doctor. We could keep going for much longer because there's so much interest in your expertise. And I want to thank you so much. She's Dr. Eileen Marty, infectious disease specialist at FIU College of Medicine. Up next, we look at Juneteenth in Florida. That's after the break. This is the Florida Roundup from Florida Public Radio. Don't go away. We'll be right back.
Welcome back to the Florida Roundup here from Florida Public Radio. Thanks again for listening and supporting public media. I'm Tom Hudson in Miami.
And I'm Melissa Ross in Jacksonville. Well, in 1991, Florida became the second state in the country after Texas to pass a law recognizing Juneteenth. It's today. And Juneteenth commemorates the day in 1865 when the last enslaved people in Texas learned of the Emancipation Proclamation. President Lincoln had signed it 2.5 years earlier.
The holiday has grown in recognition and symbolism, especially this year with weeks of protests over racial and social justice. Geraldine Thompson serves in the Florida House of Representatives, representing District 44 near Orlando. We spoke with her earlier this week. Thank you for joining us here on the Florida Roundup. How do you think the protests recently for racial justice have affected the marking of Juneteenth this year?
I think it has really drawn attention to history and culture and experiences that the larger population has not recognized or paid attention to.
There's quite a corporate recognition of Juneteenth this year, one that I don't at least recall in years past. Do you?
I can remember educational institutions recognizing Juneteenth, but not companies or businesses, and certainly not to the extent that we're seeing this year in 2020.
You have said that you'd like people to come away from Juneteenth with more than the idea of protest, but with a plan.
Absolutely.
As a legislator, what do those plans look like?
Well, one of the things that I plan to do as a legislator is to require a database managed through the Florida Department of Law Enforcement that would record all 67 counties and those police departments and those individuals where there are excessive force complaints that are out of the ordinary. Because we don't have the data, we can't require training or require a suspension. FDLE is not able to decertify individuals in law enforcement who should not be there because it raises a red flag when you have all of these complaints of excessive force. The other thing that I want to do is to look at our sovereign immunity laws. We have qualified immunity that shields individuals who misuse their authority from criminal or civil prosecution. I want to look at that to change that. What I find is that within police departments, many times if there is culpability, it is the department who pays through an insurance policy. I think the law enforcement officer should have to pay.
How do you hear the calls to defund law enforcement?
I absolutely do not support defunding law enforcement. Any society needs law and order, and so defunding the police is not the way to go, but looking at budgets and seeing the amount of budget dollars that we direct to them and seeing how we can deal with some of the systemic problems, because it's not only the police, it's unemployment, it's lack of education, it's lack of health care, it's homelessness. There's so many other things that, you know, we need to be addressing if we want a peaceful society.
The Florida Senate passed a bill in February asking the United States Congress to recognize June 19th as Juneteenth Independence Day. That bill did not move at all in the Florida House. Why not?
I don't think that people connected recognizing Juneteenth with acknowledging the history of a large part of Florida's population, and that has been problematic. And so we've got to change that. And your point that businesses are now celebrating and observing, I think, means that they want all kinds of people to see them as good corporate citizens. And unfortunately, I think that my chamber at this point is very pro-business and don't see how this is connected to business. Well, I represent the tourism corridor here in Central Florida, Disney, Universal, International Drive, the resort hotels, all of those are within my district. People are going to come to a community where there is dissension and division and turmoil and, you know, people are protest. They're not going to come. So it is a business issue. And that's the case I'm going to make when I go back so that we can get more support.
Florida State Representative Geraldine Thompson.
Well, the last enslaved people to learn about the end of slavery were in Galveston, Texas. Florida State Senator Jason Pizzo is there today. Senator Pizzo, thanks for being with us from Texas here on the Florida Roundup.
Thanks for having me.
And how is Juneteenth being observed in Galveston right now?
It's actually quite a remarkable ceremony. And, you know, I sort of believe in the idea of power in place. And State Representative Al Edwards really championed the cause to recognize for the state of Texas to actually have a real state holiday, not a lot of the memorials and sort of other situations that this other states do. But Texas really installed it as a holiday, as a remembrance in 1980. So it's been 40 years. Representative Edwards actually just passed away 6 weeks ago. So we heard from two of his sons today, Junior and Jason. And they have a traditional annual thing that I remember seeing or reading about when I was younger. So it was quite an experience to see a period piece of someone dressed up like General Granger delivering the third proclamation for the emancipation.
Now, you sponsored a bill that urges Congress to make Juneteenth a national holiday. This momentum to have the entire nation formalized Juneteenth, it's really coalesced this year as we've seen protests around the death of George Floyd and calls for racial and social justice really crystallize in the United States. Is the momentum there, do you think, to make this happen for Juneteenth?
I believe so, absolutely. Sadly, and you know, I don't have pride of authorship or presaging anything. I just think that there are sort of visceral, tangible levels of different groups of people that know when the right time to do something, and then others do it because of terrible and tragic experience. Others do it because of a passion, of empathy. Others do it because of sympathy. And then finally, I think what we're seeing on a corporate entity level, they're doing it because they should, and it's the right thing to do, and it's what a large enough amount of the public are demanding. We filed last year, and it was to urge the United States Congress, really because, as many people don't know, I guess they're looking these things up now, the United States Senate actually filed a bill, which passed in the Senate and actually did not pass in the United States Congress, in the House. Rather serendipitously, the Florida Senate, it passed unanimously through all three committees where I presented, as well as the floor unanimously, but got no traction on the House side. And I think that's going to change this year.
Hmm. This is the Florida Roundup from Florida Public Radio. And how do you see this playing out in Florida? As we noted, we were the second state after Texas to at least have a recognition of Juneteenth, but you'd like to see it go farther here in this state.
I would. I'm known to be pretty candid. So while I was presenting at one of the committees, I can't recall which of the three committees, you know, I had acknowledged that the state of Florida recognizes a number of other days in our history, which are not so memorable, nor should they be. And a lot less is celebrated and given credence than a day like this. So I believe we have the momentum. I believe it should transcend beyond a memorial to actually a day of remembrance, an actual holiday to reflect. I think sort of anecdotally, when I'm talking to my own kids, there's sort of the idea that holidays that fall within a school year are taken more seriously, or there's a history or social studies leading up to that actual day, especially if it's a day off from school. So things in the middle of the summer, with the exception of 4th of July, perhaps have gotten less attention. But I think recent tragedy and events, although repeated and not new, really will force the hand on this issue.
Yeah, I mean, certainly there are plenty of dates on the calendar that we observe that don't have the resonance of Juneteenth when you look at American history. And then going beyond the holiday, as you said, we're living through an extraordinary time in this country right now. When constituents talk to you about this movement, what are they saying to you?
It's really a mixture of emotions and introspection, some confusion, but there is a feeling of sort of at long last. But I bring up the point of sort of different groups or different levels. You know, my father taught me about the Newark riots in 67. I lived through, as a teenager, the same age as my sons now, through Rodney King in 1991 in March, you know, around the same age and around the same time. And my kids are seeing, you know, the George Floyds and the Aubreys and the Breonna Taylors. It's just, when do you hit a large enough critical mass to demand and insist that things are changed, not in a topical, reactive, popular fashion, but actually at the core? When do you start getting and revamping core values of departments, of institutions and organizations? And I think that's it. This has been the catalyst. I think this is the time for that.
We have time for a very quick call. Hope in Tampa. Go ahead, Hope. We're almost out of time.
Okay. So I have never heard of Juneteenth before. I wish I could have in school. What is the process for adding history about slavery into our current curriculum?
Thanks, Hope. Senator Pizzo.
Great question. And Hope, you're not alone. The president of the United States hadn't heard of Juneteenth either. So don't be dismayed. It's really incumbent upon the education committees that establish policy in the Florida House and the Florida Senate and the Department of Education, chaired by Commissioner Richard Corcoran, to make sure that we carve out a significant portion, and not just to talk about it for one or two days, but to actually integrate it into the history, the long fabric
into the curriculum
of American history.
And we'll have to thank you from Texas State Senator Jason Pizzo. Thank you so much for joining us on this Juneteenth.
Thank you.
And look it up if you haven't heard of it, folks. That's our show, The Florida Roundup, produced by WJCT Public Media in Jacksonville and WLRN Public Media in Miami. Heather Schatz and Denise Royal are our producers.
Jason Zabka is the WLRN Director of Radio Programming. The Director of Radio Operations at WLRN is Peter Merritt. He also is our Technical Director. We get engineering help each and every week from Doug Peterson, Charles Michaels, and Josh Torres. Alexandra Gonzalez answers the phones. Theme music provided by Miami jazz guitarist Aaron Libos at AaronLibos.com. I'm Tom Hudson.
And I'm Melissa Ross. Thanks for calling, tweeting, and listening. We'll be back next Friday. Have a great weekend.